Oh, good morning. It's another exciting day in paradise. The occasional, I don't know if you call them recruiter, but the occasional headhunter has contacted me, and I actually decided to go for this one. Remote job, mostly. I don't know if I'm even going to be considered. I think the phone number that they gave me is junk. Regardless, I left a message for them, and we'll have to do it more with emails. You have to let them know that their phone system is not, it just isn't performant. And, that's just kind of sad, honestly. In a world of outsourcing, should be able to get this stuff done without too much problems. Anyway, so I did a previous recording, which I think was really bad. I was talking to Lisa about it a little bit this morning before I left for work, and she is so endurant in putting up with me. Good soul, my wife is, in case anybody wonders about it. So something that I had put together, it's on the wiki. You never know how long anything stays on my wikis. My wikis are in terrible flux all the time. But this is what's on it currently. Because I'm trying to figure out how we get from where we are now, a telestial existence, to where the world is going. There's a lot of people that just won't make it to the millennial day because I don't know the right way to say it. There probably isn't one. People who can abide a telestial existence. We're getting rid of the people that cannot, and we're hanging on to the people who can. And if there is any indication from, say, the Book of Mormon, that's kind of how it's going to happen. In the Book of Mormon, Christ's coming to this continent was a huge cataclysmic event. The vast majority of people died. There was a kingdom set up right around that time, before that, everything was before that time, where people, there was a king called Jacob. Now, we don't know how much of land he actually ruled over. It says things had mostly fallen to tribes. Got very tribal. We have record of the 2,400 souls who after Christ's crucifixion, made it to the temple at Bountiful. I don't know if that's where the only temple was. It seems very likely that at some point Zarahemla had a temple, but apparently it was to survive the cataclysm. Anyway, so there were these circumstances. We don't know any, you know, as much as we know about weights and measures, governmental systems before, before the destruction, we know nothing about anything like that after. For so long that they stopped counting it year on year of peace, given how much time and effort was in the rule of the judges. In the Book of Mormon, you would think it was the predominant governmental form, but it was not, not even close. I think probably, I forget if it's 150, maybe less than 150 years between the setting up of this new government by King Mosiah. There were, in Nephite culture, there were far more kings than there were judges. Well, no judges, because judges could get changed out a lot. I will freely tell you that I have more confidence in kings, in righteous lines of kings, especially how it is done in the Book of Mormon, than I have in the people. The interesting thing about the judges in the Book of Mormon is the for most of the time it felt like it was inherited. Or whoever was a judge pretty much got to be the judge as long as they lived. Or felt like having it. It didn't seem like there was term limits. That's why I'm not really a term limit guy, which everybody thinks is just bizarre. Why aren't you into term limits? You go, because once you get somebody who is righteous and good, the last thing you want to do is make it so that they can't rule anymore. And in the Book of Mormon, you know, Alma was the judge for quite some time. And he basically appointed the next judge. Now, apparently it needed the voice of the people, but it kind of sounded more like a just, do you affirm Alma's choice of who needs to be this person? And it went to Pahorn, and that went well. And, of course, you know, ultimately, the sons of Pahorn, it ended up becoming a huge battle for who could have power. And people died. And then it became kind of a thing of whoever seemed to be the strongest of a particular line would do it. And then we just lost track of who it was because ultimately it sounds like things kind of fell apart. We had that wonderful Laconius. I don't know who he is in relation to anybody else, but he was the chief judge when they were having so much Gideon and robber problems, which is where I think America is at right now. I think Donald Trump is a fantastic departure from the Gadiat robbers. I don't know if he's one himself. Can I be honest? To a certain degree, economically, Gadiat robbers aren't that bad for the economy. Righteousness, most likely, really bad. But they want to keep money and keep doing things too. Now, they will practically enslave the people to make it happen. Right now, it seems like the tax money confiscated from taxpayers and businesses and other enterprises is used to accomplish larger globalist desires. For quite a while, the globalist desire has been to destroy Russia. Even though Russia, I don't really know. I think it mostly has to do with they have a lot of, number one, they have a ton of land, which is fantastic. They have a ton of resources, which is fantastic. And the globalist overlords want it. You know, whether they're actually going to do anything with it or not is a whole other question. I'm not saying that the overlords are smart or resourceful or efficient. But they do want power. If all Americans were slaves, and can I be honest, we're going in that direction, if not very close to enshrining it. Because Americans, and this includes me, I am just as gullible as anybody else is. As long as we have our cake and, feast circuses, as long as we have food, and we have little things, and we have lots of entertainment to I don't know if it distracts us. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to do anything more than just keep us kind of cowed and worried about other things. Our news media is definitely about deflection. They want to keep your eyeballs, and they want you not to be watching what the overlords are really doing, because they are either A, in the very expensive employ of the overlords. That's where I make all of my money right now, is in the very expensive employ of the overlords. Or wanting to ultimately join the ranks of the overlords, which I think is hilarious. I think a lot of these people who think they might become overlords are mostly being toyed with, and I don't know if they rise to the level of being convenient idiots. Could be. To do a lot of the overlord's work without the overlord's hands having to get dirty about it. And the whole overlord thing is kind of a European oligarch kind of feeling thing. America is a really strange thing. I think most of the powerful in our country are basically the convenient idiots of those overlords. Their job is basically to deliver money and resources to prop up the slave economies of Europe. And that is primarily the reason for the war against Russia. The Ukraine war is a proxy war beyond comprehension. The feeding and aiding of Ukraine is an absolute straw man for the larger effort for Europeans I'm sorry, and our European plays, yeah. They say, well, if America isn't going to defend Ukraine, we will. And you're going, and you can just laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh. Because slaves make crappy soldiers. Russians are hard-pressed to care about it particularly, because I don't think Ukraine is all that important. But it has to do with their survival. But I don't think they really see it. I don't think the Russian people are really all that interested in Putinism in Moscow as the leader. They are, you know, can I tell you what Russians are? Russians have always been peasants, and they continue to be peasants. In the Soviet Union time, everybody talked about the fact that they had taken out, you know, the aristocracy, and now it was ruled by the peasants. And it's just the aristocracy dressed in peasant clothes. Now, Russia doesn't have to play that game anymore, which was just the aristocracy wearing Mao jackets. That's still how it is in China. They still prop themselves up, although it's still basically a dynasty. You know, things really haven't changed. When they say, oh, the last 100 years, or the last, actually, 200 years, have been such a departure from so many things. And you go, no, not really. It's just game playing. Playing games. The same basic families that ruled over chunks of Europe, they still basically do rule over chunks of Europe. Just larger chunks, without a lot of people being able to be out of it. Anyway, so all these things. Most of the Book of Mormon covers maybe a 100-year period from the basically the end of King Mosiah until Christ's coming to America was probably not even close to 200 years. Just basically a few generations of time. I don't know what to tell people about me. By lineage, and stuff like that, I kind of have kind of a John the Baptist sort of vibe to me, you know, out in the wilderness, eating locusts and honey. I haven't gone to locusts yet, but if you saw my diet, you'd probably say, well, he's pretty darn close. I wouldn't be surprised if a good amount of my protein is ground up crickets. I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not paying attention to it particularly. I'm doing what I can do given the times that I'm in. The vast majority of my money, honestly, is dumped into Lisa's diet and trying to manage Lisa's various ailments. And that's okay. I make sufficient money now that it really doesn't matter deeply. If you just had me and Matt to feed, you could probably feed both of us on $100 a month, you know, for how much we really care about this stuff. Although we eat out quite a bit, but I think that's kind of a Lisa thing. And I'm not trying to be cheap about it because I've got money. At some point we're going to have to get cheap about it. Anyway, let's not talk about economics too much because my economics are crazy as it is. Yes, I'm a locust honey, John the Baptist, wild man out in the wilderness, who is destined to have his to say something to the wrong people and get my head chopped off. That's just the way it's ultimately going to be, probably. So when they say, and my faith and blessing says that I will be happy and content. I think what my contentment will be is with my choices. I am not a person who sits and constantly revisits the choices I've made in the past and agonizes over whether they are the right choice. I don't care. I'm doing well. My choices, I guess to a certain extent, I don't know how much really, lead to my present, and my present is okay with me. And I guess that's another definition of contentment, is saying that I'm not angry with my circumstance. Anyway, and the Book of Mormon character, now I don't know if I'm very unique in this. I think a lot of people look at this, but I don't think they look at it very intelligently, is Tienka, who I think was kind of a rebel in Captain Moroni's larger command. I don't get any impression he was particularly obedient. I certainly don't think that his big defining characteristics, what gets him written in the Book of Mormon at all, I think, is going out and killing Amalickiah and then his attempted assassination. And these are assassinations. And his attempted assassination of Amaron, his brother, Amalickiah's brother, who were the leaders of the Lamanite people. They were Nephite dissenters who found ways to take command of all the Lamanites. And mostly the Lamanites had no interest in doing anything to the Nephites. It wasn't interesting to them. But these dissenters, boy, they always stirred these guys up. The ultimate power opportunists. Anyway, so I don't know how much I am at the Yankum. But to be honest, I think I have a soul allied with the Yankum. And of course I'm this wild man out in the wilderness, like John the Baptist, preparing the way for something. Christ. So anyway, let me bring up my little thing. I don't believe I got so distracted here. Right now, we are in a world where anything goes. You can do whatever you can get away with. The powerful divine legality that doesn't usually apply to them. You know, even Danny Ant Roberts, what stability. Once they have their power, and it's somewhat consolidated, they start feeling comfortable, the first thing they want to do is make sure that nobody else rises to challenge them. And in doing that, they're perfectly willing to placate the little people. They don't want some kind of weird slave uprising, some kind of Spartacus silliness. So they make things, so, you know, they set up a basic system to placate the masses, but those things don't apply to you. I give as an example of the published, I don't know if you guys remember it, the published thing, you know, during COVID, everybody was shutting down all kinds of businesses, so people didn't share stuff, and the power elite really found out that they could do under very flimsy pretenses, get people to do all kinds of stuff that they wanted to do. We don't need slavery. We don't need enforced slavery anymore. We are slaves ourselves. We will do what our overlords tell us. And they will pit groups against other groups, stuff like that. I think the powers that be love the left and love wokeness and things like that because it keeps people fighting amongst themselves instead of coming after the elites. So, yeah, it was all about getting haircuts and beauty salon treatments during COVID. You know, Nancy Pelosi kept everything looking good during COVID when people weren't supposed to be going to the beauty shop and weren't supposed to be moving around and doing anything. You're supposed to be sequestered in your homes. And they gave the pretense of doing that, but not really doing it. They were permitted to continue to operate as they always have. You know, when people say, oh, we need to stop using airplanes, they're polluting our skies, and you go, it's funny. You know, those politicians, they're not curtailed at all. They still get all the first class, oh, come up here, treatment, oh, we'll take you to a special part of the airport that none of the ungreased masses are allowed to get near. And they do that. Of course, you go and you talk to people, they go, oh, no, I have to go through the same system you do. And many of them do. A lot of powerless, tiny little people get elected to Congress. And do they have to fly commercial? Yeah. They may even fly in coach. And you go, yeah, there it is. Of course, you know, they're going to give them a few perks. But they're perks that are easily taken away by their betters. To say, yeah, you have that now, but I'll take it away later. You know. Grooming them to do exactly what they're told and to make larger things happen. Although, the big question of is, what is the ultimate group of people who control everything, and I usually think of gangs. Drug kingpins are probably the most apt vision of how those kinds of people are, those global oligarchs, which we primarily don't know who we are. It's probably not the Rockefellers particularly. You know, Rothschilds, things like that. Anyway, the way our reality right now, which is the celestial kingdom goes, is that higher, holier people can operate in these places. You just won't see them very often. Because comparatively, there aren't very many of them. It's very interesting that Russell M. Nelson talks about these things. Because we really are trying to become the Church of the Firstborn. Right now, we're the church of I don't know exactly what. Oh, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. You go, yeah. And it says, and let me tell you, people join the church and get their membership record basically for the asking. The priesthood is basically it's a matriculation. And nobody seems vaguely interested about making it any different. There was a couple it was probably 20 years ago, where we were trying to raise the bar for like missionaries. And it was talked about once and some echoes of it for maybe a couple of years after that. But then it kind of disappeared completely. I always give the credit to Mormon mommies who think the world of their rather uninspired children and want to have, my kid must serve a mission or it's bad. The church has come back and said, we don't need to judge people if their kids get sent home early. It's because we really don't have a screening system going into it. We have to screen them during a mission. And a lot of kids get sent home. A lot of things like happen. It's a cost, but it's a cost that's absorbed. I don't have a particular problem with it. It's really hard to ascertain criteria. You can go to seminary for 4 years before you become a missionary. Some countries have this interesting thing about people coming in that are religious. They have to be trained. And our church has basically fronted seminary as the training ground. Now, there's plenty of our youth that don't do seminary anymore. Seminary has really gotten kind of... I don't really know how it works anymore. In our place, it's mostly online. And although there is a test done, number one, it's an open book test. Number two, you don't have to pass it to get credit for your time in seminary. Now, some countries and the church has had to make some adjustments to make sure that when they try to get visas for some missionaries to go to some countries, that there's an interesting looking helicopter out here. Looks almost like a crop dusting helicopter. Oh, anyway. And I think the whole thing around it is interesting. We tried to raise our standards by saying, well, we're going to raise the bar. And then that kind of got pushed to the wayside because it was like, well, that means we're going to have fewer missionaries. Although they may be better prepared, we have fewer missionaries. And what we ultimately did instead was preach my gospel. I'd call it a program. Which is basically taking somebody who has basically a light exposure to the gospel, which is what church usually provided, and really being kind of a development program for developing the Latter-day Saints. several general authorities have been big on that. You know, it's not just for missionaries, it's for everybody. It's a wonderful thing for everybody. Because it's basically a development program. Mostly to get you into better habits. Scripture study. Doing good things. Some light gospel learning. I don't think it's even really that big, that good. I think it has basically supplanted the Gospel Principles Manual for what's really important for Latter-day Saints to know. And it's gotten more simplified, I think, over the years. It's been a ton of time since I've actually done it, because a whole lot of the Preach My Gospel, when it first came out, that we were going through with our children, were interesting. You know, there was a whole section I didn't do because it was mostly about how to schedule your day, what was important to get ready for missionary work and stuff like that. Well, missionary work is really kind of, you know, at first there was prophesying missionaries and service missionaries. They've kind of gotten merged together a bit, that mission presidents now supervise both proselyting and service missionaries. Now to the point to where I think basically all missionaries function a lot like service missionaries, with a little bit of proselyting in there. My wonderful wife was very, very much of the opinion that one of our sons that served the service mission could have easily served a proselyting mission. And anyway, so I'm not going to say what I was about to say. I'm not going to speak badly of my wife. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Anyway, okay, I'm sorry. I keep letting this thing click off. I should. Okay, where we are going to be. And this is interesting because the only comparison we have between, the only thing that we have between the terrestrial status and the celestial status is this idea of valiant, being valiant. And I've been trying to figure out how that would translate. So here, let me tell you what I have. Basic obedience to Christ. You know? They basically do what they're supposed to do, which is probably the best people that we have to a large extent. The higher and holier people can still live in that kind of environment, and it works. You know, higher and holier people can continue to be higher and holier in whatever circumstance they go in. That's what makes the Lord, God's development program, work so well. In fact, it works better under the circumstances of it being kind of challenging and not running with the crowd. The LDS Church, I don't know if it's still that way, but for a long time, it was trying just to create a better crowd to run with. And we've taken, and let me tell you, especially Utah Latter-day Saints have been taking incredible flack for not treating other people who aren't members of the church, very well. Those people aren't like us. I don't want you to make friends with those people. And it was kind of weird sideline thing, being in the world and not of the world. Everybody coming back and saying, oh, we just need to be nice to these people. I think it's interesting because the Book of Mormon and other scriptures talks about the ultimate division that has to be done. The very first part of the Book of Mormon, the Nephites had to separate them. They couldn't live in the same land as the Lamanites. They had to get up and move, and they got up and moved from, I guess, the land of Nephi, and they ultimately settled with the people in Zarahemla. But there had been other separations before that, and it was a story of separations after that. There was only really one mission to the Lamanites, where they got a group of Lamanites, and they came out, and they became righteous, and they chose, and you know, and they got, and they were under the protection of the Nephites. We do know that ultimately the Lamanites became more righteous than the Nephites, but I can't help but think that that was a question of being relative. And that it seemed like there was more mixing among the groups then. Samuel the Lamanite was a righteous Lamanite, and we sometimes get the impression that he was part of kind of one of these merged groups a little bit, but I don't think so. I don't know. I just don't know. Anyway. Right now, I think the brethren have noticed some problems. I don't know if it's been the brethren. It's probably the brethren for me are basically the 15, the Quorum of the 12, and the First Presidency. That's who I term the brethren. The 70s, I kind of say, okay, whatever, you know. They are a varying mix of people, you know. Anyway, so we've been hearing more from the 70s, not so much from the apostles, but maybe a little bit of not treating newcomers to Utah so bad. Everybody who comes says, well, the Mormons don't let us into their circles. You know, we're not friends with them. It's not because these people aren't trying. It's because the Mormons are kind of like, hey, I'm sorry. It's part of my religion not to be, you know, not to let you into my group. I'm trying to make sure that you don't influence my children for bad. And there's been some hitback for being like that. But can I be honest? As there's been more mixing, Utah's not used to mixing. When I was in Utah in the 1980s, mid 1980s, Utah was still very much just Utah. When I Salt Lake City was somewhat cosmopolitan, because large cities do that. The smaller places were not. I started out in the suburbs of Salt Lake City, Granger, moved to Tooele, which is like not a Latter-day Saint. That was really the first place where any place in Utah had missionaries, because Tooele, Utah is really kind of it's really hard to say. Latter-day Saints founded it and settled it, but for the most part it got taken over by military other needs, other kinds of people out there. Tula was always seen as strange people. You know? And then, of course, I got sent to Wendover on an emergency, and that kind of got, and that's a totally different attitude. That's mostly Mormons that like to gamble, or Mormons working out there. And there wasn't very many of them. There was a branch out there when I was there. Anyway, and then I went to Spanish Fork, which is deep in, you know, that's Utah County. That's untrammeled Mormon Central. Before Provo became somewhat cosmopolitan, and Spanish Fork was something of a suburb, became a suburb of Provo. My missionary work there was mostly, I called it home teaching, because I would go to the identified non-members, part-member families, and kind of do them kind of in a cycle. I was there for nearly a year, and it was wild. Anyway, 98% Mormon, which now only little bitty settlements far away from the Wasatch Front have that many Latter-day Saints in them. It's just not that predominant. But there's still this thing of you don't need to interface with these people, you know. People who move into Utah feel somewhat shunned. And they said, no, you can't do that. You can't treat people like that. You have to be better neighbors. It's hard because back in the old days, it was easy, you know. You lived in Utah, therefore, you had the preferred environment. And you didn't have to deal with people who weren't Latter-day Saints very often at all. And people would come to Utah, you know, you'd come for a job in Salt Lake City, you would do your little Salt Lake City tour, and then you'd get the heck out of there. Now there's plenty of people who've lived there for a while, and they say, you know, tired of being treated like a second-class citizen. I moved here, and I can't believe I'm being treated like a second-class citizen. And you're going, you really are moving to a foreign country. And all of our leaders are trying, not all of them, many of our leaders are saying, you can't just treat these people like foreigners. And I don't know. I don't know if that's good or not. This is, you know, I don't think there's a lot of evil that comes from being somewhat insular. Now, does it help missionary work in Utah? No. It makes people who say, you know, I don't want to have to live by you LDS people rules. You know, the social justice warriors start swooping in and trying to destroy Utah and make it the way they want it. And you go, you guys have invaded a foreign country in the United States. And, says, I don't really know what to do it. In the celestial world, Christ will define larger rules. And everyone in those situations has to deal with those rules. I guess I was trying to get to the point to where places like Utah, kind of insular countries within other countries, that this is kind of the way it's going to be. If you come to Utah, you're going to have to live by Utah rules. Well, of course, the problem is, in the United States, if you get enough people together, you can just wipe out a lot of those kinds of things. You know, now we have gay marriage. We got a bunch of transgender laws in place where you can't say boo to a transgender person without them being able to get you thrown in jail for something. It hasn't quite got to that point, but they'd like for it to get to that point, you know. You have special, very draconian laws to protect the oppressed. The blacks love it. They're like, oh, we love the transgenders. Why? It's just because they're actually helping us do what we want to do, which is basically get paid for breathing. You know, we want reparations. And you go, you guys are sad. They got all cooked up with the whole thing that just because they have black skin and their parents may have been slaves at one time, actually, many black people are not from slave stock. They came here under other pretenses, and, you know, I don't think much of the whole reparations thing. It's mostly people saying, hey, I just want a free ride. I want other people to pay for my life, and I don't want to, you know, since I don't have to work. And, you know, I get that. I understand that completely. I have tried to do that for myself on occasion. You know, either the whole autism silliness or anything like that. Anyway. Okay. And what it did was, is it becomes this big thing between what's the difference between a celestial person, a Selly, and a terrestrial, a Terry, that is the differentiator. Like I said, all we have from the scriptures is valiant. That people in the celestial kingdom are more valiant than those who are in the terrestrial. So I've been trying to figure out what that means. And I think it's mostly about your motivation and obedience. Terries keep the rules because they're just the rules. Are they really motivated to do it? No, not really. This is, of course, if they don't do it, they can't stay there. So that's really the separating line between that kind of an existence and another one. Now, we're ultimately going to have rewards that are fixed. And the Terry reward is that you will have Christ's rules and you will live with them. This is, I don't have any idea if you're going to like them. There's been some ideas that these individual glories will be the place where we really want to be, or that are consistent with our natures. I go, I don't know. I think it's just where you are willing to be. If you can't really handle a terrestrial glory, and I think that's what judgment really is about. Is about, if I stick you here, will you be able to live like this into the eternities? And it's like, you can do that kind of thing in life. I did what I was told to do, you know, and then all of a sudden people, when their guard is down, they go, I can't do this anymore! I can't do this anymore! You know, I've got to, you know, give me my drugs, or I've got to beat up on this other person. I've got to do all these things. I'm tired of being so constrained. And you go, a guy that was trying to live Terry and ended up living Telly. And ended up Telly. And you go, yeah. And you're going, it's not because, well, yeah, it sort of is because you're a bad person. But it is what you are, you know, to a certain extent. You get to decide what you are. And that can be tricky. That can be real tricky. Anyway, so the big question is how grudging is their obedience to Christ's standard for carries. That's kind of what I get. Is it grudging? You know, is that really the difference between a Selly and a Terry? Is how grudging they are to their circumstances. I don't know. We are very accustomed to our plasticity in mortality. And we think we will continue to be that way going forward. You know, I can turn over a new leaf. I can make a change. I can do this and I can do that, and then I can decide to stop doing those things. And that's a real feature of mortality. Somebody who comes into it one way can leave very differently. But we tend to project that plasticity forward. I don't think that works. I think we are very much stuck as who we are. I think the resurrection itself tends to lock us into a state. The way we are when we leave this life is the way we will be in the spirit world. Is kind of an offshoot statement that kind of sounds like that. I guess you could look at it as putting on a suit of clothes. The suit of clothes that fits you most comfortably. Maybe that's a part of resurrection. Is that, yes, you have a body that looks the way it does. Of course, it'll be all fixed up and cleaned up and looking good. What kind of garb you feel most comfortable in? In this world, you can wear whatever you want. Everybody sees Satan is a really snappy dresser. Maybe that's true. Maybe the most snappiest dressers aren't necessarily celestial. I don't know. I'm probably not a candidate for church office because my tendency is not to be wearing a suit. I wore a suit on my mission. I wore a tie. When I got off my mission, I rarely wore suits and ties after that. I have tried to be the CIO of a college and dress how I felt was appropriate for that sort of role. I tend to roll up my sleeves. I didn't tend to wear ties, although most didn't wear ties. I did not tend to wear a suit coat at all. And it was obvious I wasn't that sort of a person. Now, I have absolutely no idea what that means for a celestial thing. I don't know if it's like, you know, three-piece suit, Armani. Right now, the brethren give every impression that these are the sort of people, and they get those sort of people because they're used to dressing that way, dressing for success sort of way of being. I'm not that sort. It's like, never, if you got to be that sort, you could be those kind of people. And he says, you know, I guess I don't care enough for that to be my thing. So, yeah, that's an idea too. Does it really fit into those kinds of models? Well, regardless. Okay, so let's keep going with this. This is, I will keep the rules, but I would rather not, left to myself. But probably not, as this is torturous rather than a reward. See, I don't know where you go with that. You know? I don't see how lower cellies can be valiant and not get exaltation. See, that's the tricky part. Is really, who do you have in the celestial glory? And it seems like you have a whole bunch of interesting people there. Maybe it's just what you're interested in doing. Celestial kingdom is populated by a lot of people. Many of them are angels. I've always thought that it was kind of like Downton Abbey. You have the villagers in Downton Village. You had the staff, which were the angels, although it really has more to do with somebody upper crust tied to the house itself. And then you had the family, who was the exalted ones. You know, and you go, man, I, you know, and can I ever not say that, exaltation is a whole lot of being the head person at the table, being, having your excellent food provided for you. There's a difference between running around naked in a garden, having plenty of food and stuff like that around. I don't know if that's particularly terrestrial, although I've heard, and I don't have a problem with the fact that that might be how the terrestrial kingdom is. There's a bunch of people that just don't think about that stuff, and everything's provided for them. Although I think mostly in the celestial reward, there's a difference between the celestial status and the celestial reward. In the reward, you don't have to worry about food either. Of course, you have to sit there and say, are there Snicker bar trees there? You know, when you think of a celestial, you have all the food that you need. You can take it just as it comes, which I don't know. Maybe I tend to do that just because I'm kind of lazy. And, I'm doing fine, thanks.
Thank you for one.
Thank you. Hold the line is the, I don't know what you call it, the shout. Rally of the units here, this wing. Anyway, okay. So yeah, and you go, how important is this really? And you go, well, you really have to have a good idea of where you're trying to go to and what's important about it. I say I'm lazy, but I'm not really good at it, you know. Indicative the fact that I'm going for this silly job that's going to be a whole lot more work. It's like never really sucks at being got kind of a lazy job right now, and it's making me nuts. It's weird. It doesn't make a lot of sense. So anyway, being valiant, I just don't know. And also, those who, how can somebody who's valiant not make it to exaltation? And so I started looking at it as a military engagement. Since I work among the military, it's interesting to watch different people. Most of the people around here do their jobs. And I guess you can see a difference between those who really kind of engage and those who are just kind of doing the basics, getting the job done. They're going to get promotions along the way, but they are really different than those who do really excellent promotions, who promote quickly and stay in and really enjoy the lifestyle and almost the painful meritocracy of the military. And you can see the tellies as people who, even if they do join the military, their basic idea is, I'm just going to do, you know, I just took it because I couldn't find a job or stuff like that. And if they can avoid being in the military, they will. And that somebody else can do whatever fighting or sacrificing needs to be done to keep, you know, freedom and liberty and things like that. And then the Terrys are the guys who will do it because, you know, it's the responsibility. You know, you drafted into the military, or, you know, or to be a good American, you need to be part of the military. And you provide support for the effort as it's needed. But yeah, you go, well, not a whole lot of putting forth greater efforts, stuff like that. Not heroism. You know, ranks come as they come, you know. You're going to do your 20. I think that's still kind of a Terry sort of way of looking at it. And you just kind of deal with the way the military is. You know, you don't put yourself in the position of being able to lead, to make changes, except that it's required. You know, if you're going to have this rank, you're going to have a squad under you. If you have this rank, you're going to have to be responsible for this group of people. And it's like, that's whatever, fine. Okay, that's mostly the telly way of looking at it. Sellies are the true believers. Sacrifice themselves to the cause. Career soldiers lead out in campaigns and take the hard assignment. When there's a hard assignment that needs to be doing, you know, you might do it because it makes you look good or might help you toward a promotion. But often you just do it because it just needs to be done. And you say, I'll do it. You know, Christ was definitely there's a hard thing to be done, and I'll do it. And so you don't ever want to say a bad thing about people that go into it with that kind of an attitude. It's not troublesome at all. They go out and they do it. The highest will take leadership roles, adopt protection of the land and the people as their own mission. It's kind of like the whole thing with the agenda of God. God tells us what his agenda is and what he works to accomplish. And your contributing to this makes you somewhat celestial. This is now where you are in the celestial glory is kind of a whole other thing. And I wouldn't be surprised if the whole thing did smell vaguely military. The church smells vaguely military on some level with its hierarchical structure and all those things. But anyway, so there it is. That's what I have to say on this particular one. I'm going to go ahead and stop now, and we will this thing go.